From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. The 15th annual City Lit Festival Saturday will include scores of sessions for writers and for readers, stories about motherhood, about racial, gender, and socioeconomic passing, one-on-one editing sessions with established writers, and a masterclass with poet Yrsa Daly Ward about fearlessly writing your truth. As City Lit Project Director Carla Dupre explains,
we're trying to get the literary audience connected in a very different way. We're trying to grow their experience. And to me, writing's about opening up yourself to different kind of experiences. Writing is about empathy.
And keynote speaker Philip Gurevich on what the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide teaches about memory, forgetting, and hiding. All on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning. I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Baltimore's literary legacy reaches back to the works of giants like H.L. Mencken, Zora Neale Hurston, Gertrude Stein, and Edgar Allan Poe. And City Lit Project, now in its 15th year, continues to deepen Baltimore's reputation for literary accomplishment and appreciation with the City Lit Festival, which takes place this Saturday. Later, we'll talk with longtime New Yorker journalist Philip Gurevich. He'll deliver the keynote speech at the festival. Right now, Executive Director Carla Dupre is here to talk about some of the highlights and opportunities for writers and readers alike. Welcome back to On the Record, Carla.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about the history of the City Lit Festival.
Let's see. It was a dark and stormy night, I like to say. But Hurricane Isabel in 2003 wiped out the Baltimore Book Festival. It used to be a two-day event. But at that time, the literary community convened and decided they couldn't wait 2 years for another festival. So they got together and thought, why not have a one-day festival at the Enoch Pratt Library? At the same time, City Lit Project became a nonprofit, and they merged the two. And that's how the festival was born.
So there's a City Lit Festival in the spring,
and
a book festival.
And a book festival, City Lit Stage is part of the Baltimore Book Festival as well in the fall.
And your festival, the City Lit Festival, as you mentioned, has been at the main library. That's changing this year?
Well, because they went through a renovation. Enoch Pratt went through a renovation, so we had to take a deep breath and figure out where else to have it. So we're having it at the University of Baltimore, who are their great hosts, at the William H. S. Thummel Business Center. It'll be there this year, as it was last year.
There are a lot of opportunities and resources for writers at this event. What are some of those?
Well, what we are saying to people, if you're a writer, you have no business being anywhere else but at this festival. We have four funders coming in to talk to writers about grants. They're giving hands-on information. They're there for questions. We have someone from Maryland Citizens from the Arts, Nicholas Cohen, coming in to talk about advocacy. We have playwriting, screenwriting. We have publishing professionals from, you know, publicists, small press publishers, talking about how to get your work out there. We have different panels of poets who have new releases. It's just such a wealth of things. We even have a storytelling session, Listen to Your Mother. And what we're trying to say to people is, even if you think you have a story in you, don't wait too long, because the resources are right there. We're trying to give people the opportunity if they, you know, a lot of people cannot afford to go to these higher institutions to learn the craft. We're saying we have the tools. We have the writers. We're presenting over 80 writers at this festival. That means accessibility. All of our sessions are free except for our 30-minute one-on-one critiques. We got five incredible editors to sit down for 30 minutes to talk to someone about their work. That doesn't happen many places. We have a master class, a poet, a great poet, Yrsa Daly Ward's coming in to talk to people about how to write things that are really kind of hard to discuss, how to put that kind of information on the page without freezing, without choking up, without thinking, oh my gosh, I'm telling my life story. That's an hour and a half with a major poet that is here in Baltimore.
And that one costs
$10. $10 to attend.
Are there still openings?
Still openings. And all I can say is, you know, because there's always that last minute hurry, get it in, register. We had a writer from the session last year who said she's in an MFA program. The feedback she received transformed the way she thought about her own work simply because she had a stranger looking at her work. And we want to continue to just have that experience, bring that experience to writers.
And the one-on-one editing sessions that you talked about, there's a $5 charge for those.
There's actually a $10 charge. There are five editors from 10 till 12, 30-minute slots. We're trying to keep up with our website with the sold-out sign as much as possible. But just check with us. If you, for whatever reason, you register and there's no slots left, we will definitely contact you to let you know.
And we, of course, will link to your website from the On the Record page at WYPR.org. So lots of resources for writers. What about what's there for readers?
The same thing. We have, first of all, we're handling some really kind of tough topics, like Find a Way is based on the Diane Nyett story about sexual abuse. We have about five writers. They're talking about how to get by. If this has happened to you, how to live beyond that experience. We have a panel called Writing from the Margins, which means talking about those untold stories in our families that we have to kind of mine out because they're there. They've been there for generations. We're trying to talk to writers about how to research and find out this information and then write about it. We have a roundtable discussion about fiction, new fiction that's coming out, Jane Delury's new book, The Balcony. We have a 92-year-old author, debut author, coming out with a memoir. We have short fiction because we're really clear some people cannot write novels or don't want to, they're not even interested in the novel form. So we want to talk to them about writing in a short form, which is a little bit more difficult. We have Timmy Reed discussing it with writers Ho Lin and Stephanie Allen. There's a panel called Always Loaded, Never Safe, Guns on the Page and in the Streets. Just an evocative conversation about gun culture. And we encourage a community discussion about that. And we're doing a story about passing, We Wear the Mask. It's a book edited by Lisa Page. She's going to talk about what it's like to have to, you know, because the history of passing in the African-American community. But what that looks like, what those stories do to generations. So I get so excited about it because there's so many things that we have that we want writers to be brave to step out of their genre. If you're used to writing poetry, listening to poetry, we're asking you to start thinking about creative nonfiction. Start thinking about playwriting. Start thinking about screenwriting. We're also trying to appeal to the younger audience who may not feel like they don't know which genre to build in, or an older audience who's always been taught only one, stick to one genre. We're saying get out of your own skin. Try something new. And this is the place to do it.
That's Carla Dupre, Executive Director of City Lit Project here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the 15th Annual City Lit Festival happening this Saturday, April 14th at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center. You mentioned poetry. There seems to be an emphasis on poetry this year. Is that a different gateway for reading and writing audiences?
There is, but let me tell you this. Poetry... a lot of people read poetry, but a lot of people don't listen to it. And we think there's a different experience when you listen to poets. We're featuring Elizabeth Acevedo, who has a debut book out called Poet X, about a young teen coming into her own as a spoken word artist. And this young teen is living in it's kind of a strict Catholic home, but what it's like to find her own voice. We're featuring Furious Flower Poetry Center, who's the founder, Joanne Gabin, is from Baltimore. She's going to talk about starting the first academic center for African-American poetry. We're trying to introduce poets because my experience with Furious Flower is that if you write poetry, you need to know about this center. They do fabulous conferences, fabulous workshops, fabulous tributes to our best-known legendary poets. They've done Toni Morrison. They've done Lucille Clifton, Maya Angelou. We're trying to get the literary audience connected in a very different way. We're trying to grow their experience. And to me, writing's about opening up yourself to different kind of experiences. Writing is about empathy. We're trying to get people to understand that there's a big world out there. We are here. This particular region is filled with different cultures, and there's nothing like seeing themselves reflected on the page. And we're also trying to tell the arts community that the literary artists are here. We hear a lot about the fine arts, you know, performing arts and visual arts, but literary artists are here in this region, and we're strong.
Are there any highlights you haven't already shared with us? You're so excited about this
festival. I am excited about it. Well, one thing I have to say, this festival is in its 15th year, and our founder, Greg Wilhelm, is about to leave this area to take on a position as director of the creative writing department at George Mason University.
I did not know that.
Yes. So this is...
A farewell.
Kind of like a farewell to him, because we know he's always like one step away from us. But this is a way to say that, look, this is what you did. You know, bringing this festival, this kind of organization is very unique. There aren't a lot of places like City Lit. And for 15 years, we put a lot of people on this stage, a lot of platforms for writers, spoken word artists, emerging artists, putting them on the stage with, you know, seasoned artists. That's kind of like paying homage to him, too, saying, look what you've done. You've created this great thing.
So there's a 15-year legacy, but what would you hope a first-time visitor comes away with after visiting the City Lit Festival?
Well, I'll tell you what. I just spoke to someone who just moved into the area, and she said she's moved from Philadelphia. She's trying to find a literary arts community. And what I said to her was, there's no way you're going to walk away from this festival thinking you're alone. There's no way. There are too many people, too many resources. We have 40 exhibitors in our literary marketplace. These are people who publish. These are people who have magazines. These are people who are interested, invested in the literary arts community. There is no way anyone will walk away from this festival thinking they're alone. Our editors, they make sure they're not told to reach back and talk to some of the people that whose manuscripts they critique. But they do, because they realize that writing can be a lonely experience. But in Baltimore, in this region, no way. No way, we got you. And we want to tell writers too, we want to tell funders that look at us, we're here, take care of us, take care of these individual literary artists, take care of people like City Lit. You know, recognize that we have an impact, a huge impact.
I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carla Dupre is executive director of City Lit Project. The 15th annual City Lit Festival runs from 9:30 to 5:30 this Saturday, April 14th, at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center at 11 West Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. After the break, we'll talk with the festival's keynote speaker, Philip Gerecht. I'm Sheila Kass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. The 15th annual City Lit Festival is happening on Saturday. That's our topic today. We heard about some of the festival highlights from City Lit Project Executive Director Carla Dupre. One of those highlights is keynote speaker Philip Gerecht, who joins us today by phone. Gerecht has been a staff writer at The New Yorker for more than 20 years and served as editor of the Paris Review for 5 years. He's the author of The Ballad of Abu Ghraib, Standard Operating Procedure, and also of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and a place on the Guardian newspaper's list of the 100 greatest nonfiction books of the last 2,500 years. Gerecht is completing another book called You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. Welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you.
Philip Gerecht, your book, We Wish to Inform You, was a gripping account of the horrors of the Rwandan state-sponsored genocide in which 800,000 Tutsis were massacred in a matter of months. You wrote that 20 years ago. How do you think the experience of reporting so in-depth on that event has shaped you as a writer?
It's always difficult to say because it's hard to know how things would have gone if I hadn't done something. And so... in some ways, of course, it's just a very deep part of me over time. I suppose that at some level, writing about the Rwandan genocide and the world's response and the immediate aftermath and the dilemma of how, in the aftermath of such intensive and intimate communal killing, and violence. People are supposed to reconstitute a society. I certainly think of it as a kind of deep political education. And oddly, at the time, I would have said, well, I went there with a fairly pessimistic view of history, which is not to say that everything's terrible, but that I don't think that things necessarily improve much. Came away with that confirmed. But 20 years later, although things are still very fragile and troubled there, I have a somewhat more of a sense that things can change.
Well, let me pick up on that because, of course, your next book, this coming book, is also about Rwanda, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. Tell us what it's about.
Really, it's returning to Rwanda over the last decade now. So from about the time of the 15th anniversary of the genocide till now, where we're on the right now, Rwanda is in the course of this week commemorating the 24th anniversary of the genocide of 1994. And I was really looking at how is it that, I mean, right at the time that I first went there, which was a year afterwards, you really had a very strong sense from almost everybody that nobody could tell you how can this be put back together. In Eastern Europe, after the fall of communism, they used to have an expression, I think mostly from Poland, but everybody was using it, which was, we all know it's easy to make fish soup out of an aquarium, but nobody really knows how to make an aquarium out of fish soup. And it's a pretty good graphic image for just, you know, when things are so wrecked, how do you reconstitute a viable society from it? And it really was dumbfounding because at that point, close to a million people had been killed out of a population of about 7.5 to 8 million. At least half the population of those who were remained were displaced, either internally or as refugees outside the country. A million people who had been refugees before the war were streaming back into a country that they barely knew and that had been destroyed. The infrastructure was destroyed. And so there was also this feeling, this can't go away quickly. However wrong all the ideas and identity politics that might have led to this level of violence, and however transparently exposable they are as errors, blood makes them true. This level of fear and violence and the impulse to revenge is going to make this go on for a long time to come. And there were years of violence that followed, though it was a diminishing level of violence, especially inside Rwanda. Some of it continued quite terribly in Congo for a long time and to this day. But in Rwanda, there was a stability under essentially an authoritarian, at first mostly military, but now a sort of established authoritarian state, and a process of, again, top-down forced coexistence that has become, with time, and certainly to a degree, quite real. And one always has to wonder, how solid is it? How fragile is it? There's in some way no way to know until a lot of time goes by. But the longer that time goes by, I can say that nobody would have bet 25 years ago or 24 years ago that it would have come this far in the form that it has. And so that is remarkable. And it's demanded a great deal of the actual people who are living there, in terms of restraint, in terms of overcoming extremely bitter feelings, in terms of accepting what seems like a very unacceptable set of arrangements as the least bad alternative and the only one that can be made better. And to some extent, thinking that maybe there's some hope that a future generation won't carry this as poisonously.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Philip Gurevich, longtime New Yorker, staff writer, and author. He'll be the keynote speaker at the City Lit Festival on Saturday. We're talking about his book project in the works, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. That title implies a burden on both sides. Do you have a sense of it falling more heavily on the victims or the former killers?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. When I first heard that phrase It was a long time ago. It was 20-some years ago. It's an expression in Kinyarwanda, the language of Rwanda. When I first heard it, I thought it was very dark, very sinister, or cynical. You hide that you hate me, and I hide that I know that. It was a kind of a gallows humor at best when people would say it, you know, like, ain't that the way it is? And then I started to think about it more recently when I was going back in the recent years, and I thought, it's actually a description of civil order. What's the alternative? The alternative is that you don't hide it, and we know where that leads. So you can't ask everybody to get rid of, I mean, hate's a strong word, but any, you know, adversarial feelings and hostilities and resentment and fears and all of that. But you can ask them not to manifest them. And with time, you can hope that by doing so, you create an order that's its own reward and that organizes people well. I mean, it's not that different from what the British might have called the gentlemanly code. And so it does lay a burden on everybody. And as somebody said to me at one point when I was asking them, you know, do you know this expression, Rwanda? And he was like, well, yes, everybody knows that expression. And he said, but of course, what it means is nothing's hidden. Because if we both know what's being hidden, it's not exactly a secret. So what they mean by hiding is really not manifesting. Violent antagonisms, feelings of vengeance, feelings that divide people in a way that makes society non-functional.
Were you able to locate and interview people you had talked to for the first book?
Yeah, some of them, certainly not all of them, but many of them. And in fact, a good deal of my time from the very beginning, I was always interested in going back to one particular village where there was a killer and a set of the survivors of the families that he and his crew had attacked, whom I had met in 1996 the first time. And I'd always wondered how the whole thing had played out in the long aftermath. And over the last decade, I've gone back there repeatedly to that one very small community and followed both him and some of these survivors for what ended up being for the rest of their lives as they had their went through the various stages of dealing with the fact that they had to live around each other. But so, yes, many people were findable, though that first book was reported before really the internet had reached Rwanda and, or was much functional here even.
In We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Family, Stories from Rwanda, you revealed details of a genocide that much of the world ignored while it was happening. What are you hoping to accomplish in writing this next book?
Well, I think that the first book, in a sense, is more obvious as to why it might interest us, that we know that we might be interested in learning about something immense that took place in our own lifetime. But in fact, I think that in terms of the real complexity and immensity of the story comes out much more in the aftermath. In some odd way, I sometimes say the genocide was the easy part. And by that, I don't mean for people to live through. I mean to get one mind around. You know, it's consuming violence. You'll never fully get it. But you understand that once it was underway, it followed a kind of pattern. But what's being demanded of people when they're being asked to reconcile or forgive or just accept and coexist with others who have offended to that degree, and you ask yourself really fundamental questions, like, shouldn't some things be unforgivable? And isn't anger both a burden and a virtue? And, you know, is memory always, as we often say, oh, we must always remember everything, never forget, and remember as a kind of cure, because the things that get forgotten are silenced, and what's silenced will come back to bite us in one way or another. There's a lot of truth to that. That's why we all are aware of it. But also, memory can be a terrible burden and a kind of heavy weight. And, you know, in the 90s, when the genocide happened, there was a widespread view, I think, in the world, at least amongst Westerners in the United States or in Europe looking at Rwanda, that, well, you know, we're lucky, we've sorted out how things should be run in a society. They should adapt and be more like us. We've got everything sorted out about these kinds of conflicts or so. And we forget that in Europe it happened 45 years ago. Now we're at a time in American history where the Civil War seems more pressingly, urgently hot than it has since 150 years ago, maybe in terms of our public debates. and the unresolved issues that trailed behind it. You know, things that you think are settled aren't. And so I think that these immense questions of how does one put a society together? How does one make an aquarium out of fish soup? I'm not going to be able to answer those fully, but I can certainly explore them in a case where a lot of people are really grappling with that at the deepest possible level. And I think that that is what I hope to describe.
Lots to think about. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich, longtime staff writer at The New Yorker. We've been talking about his upcoming book, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. At noon Saturday, Gurevich will keynote the 15th City Lit Book Festival at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center, 11 West Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening On the Record. Be back with us tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.
From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The 15th annual City Lit Festival Saturday will include scores of sessions for writers and for readers, stories about motherhood, about racial, gender, and socioeconomic passing, one-on-one editing sessions with established writers, and a masterclass with poet Yrsa Daly Ward about fearlessly writing your truth. As City Lit Project Director Carla Dupre explains,
we're trying to get the literary audience connected in a very different way. We're trying to grow their experience. And to me, writing is about opening up yourself to different kind of experiences. Writing is about empathy.
And keynote speaker Philip Gurevich on what the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide teaches about memory, forgetting, and hiding. All on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Baltimore's literary legacy reaches back to the works of giants like H.L. Mencken, Zora Neale Hurston, Gertrude Stein, and Edgar Allan Poe. And City Lit Project, now in its 15th year, continues to deepen Baltimore's reputation for literary accomplishment and appreciation with the City Lit Festival, which takes place this Saturday. Later, we'll talk with longtime New Yorker journalist Philip Gurevich. He'll deliver the keynote speech at the festival. Right now, Executive Director Carla Dupre is here to talk about some of the highlights and opportunities for writers and readers alike. Welcome back to On the Record, Carla.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about the history of the City Lit Festival.
Let's see. It was a dark and stormy night, I like to say. But Hurricane Isabel in 2003 wiped out the Baltimore Book Festival. It used to be a two-day event. But at that time, the literary community convened and decided they couldn't wait 2 years for another festival. So they got together and thought, why not have a one-day festival at the Enoch Pratt Library? At the same time, City Lit Project became a nonprofit, and they merged the two. And that's how the festival was born.
So there's a City Lit Festival in the spring,
and
a book festival.
And a book festival, City Lit Stage is part of the Baltimore Book Festival as well in the fall.
And your festival, the City Lit Festival, as you mentioned, has been at the main library. That's changing this year?
Well, because they went through a renovation. Enoch Pratt went through a renovation, so we had to take a deep breath and figure out where else to have it. So we're having it at the University of Baltimore, who are their great hosts, at the William H. S. Thummel Business Center. It'll be there this year, as it was last year.
There are a lot of opportunities and resources for writers at this event. What are some of those?
Well, what we are saying to people, if you're a writer, you have no business being anywhere else but at this festival. We have four funders coming in to talk to writers about grants. They're giving hands-on information. They're there for questions. We have someone from Maryland Citizens from the Arts, Nicholas Cohen, coming in to talk about advocacy. We have playwriting, screenwriting. We have publishing professionals from, you know, publicists, small press publishers, talking about how to get your work out there. We have different panels of poets who have new releases. It's just such a wealth of things. We even have a storytelling session, Listen to Your Mother. And what we're trying to say to people is, even if you think you have a story in you, don't wait too long, because the resources are right there. We're trying to give people the opportunity if they, you know, a lot of people cannot afford to go to these higher institutions to learn the craft. We're saying we have the tools. We have the writers. We're presenting over 80 writers at this festival. That means accessibility. All of our sessions are free except for our 30-minute one-on-one critiques. We got five incredible editors to sit down for 30 minutes to talk to someone about their work. That doesn't happen many places. We have a master class, a poet, a great poet, Ursa Daly Ward's coming in to talk to people about how to write things that are really kind of hard to discuss, how to put that kind of information on the page without freezing, without choking up, without thinking, oh my gosh, I'm telling my life story. That's an hour and a half with a major poet that is here in Baltimore.
And that one costs
$10. $10. $10
to attend. Still openings?
Still openings. And all I can say is, you know, because there's always that last minute hurry, get it in. Register. We had a writer from the session last year who said she's in an MFA program. The feedback she received transformed the way she thought about her own work simply because she had a stranger looking at her work. And we want to continue to just have that experience, bring that experience to writers.
And the one-on-one editing sessions that you talked about, there's a $5 charge for those.
There's actually a $10 charge. There are five editors from 10 till 12, 30-minute slots. We're trying to keep up with our website with the sold out sign as much as possible. But just check with us. If you, for whatever reason, you register and there's no slots left, we will definitely contact you to let you know.
And we, of course, will link to your website from the On the Record page at WYPR.org. So lots of resources for writers. What about what's there for readers?
The same thing. We have, first of all, we're handling some really kind of tough topics, like Find a Way is based on the Diane Nyett story about sexual abuse. We have about five writers there talking about how to get by. If this has happened to you, how to live beyond that experience. We have a panel called Writing from the Margins, which means talking about those untold stories in our families that we have to kind of mine out because they're there. They've been there for generations. We're trying to talk to writers about how to research and find out this information and then write about it. We have a roundtable discussion about fiction, new fiction that's coming out, Jane Delury's new book, The Balcony. We have a 92-year-old author, debut author, coming out with a memoir. We have short fiction because we're really clear some people cannot write novels or don't want to, they're not even interested in the novel form. So we want to talk to them about writing in a short form, which is a little bit more difficult. We have Timmy Reed discussing it with writers Ho Lin and Stephanie Allen. There's a one panel called Always Loaded, Never Safe, Guns on the Page and in the Streets. Just an evocative conversation about gun culture. And we encourage a community discussion about that. And we're doing a story about passing, We Wear the Mask. It's a book edited by Lisa Page. She's going to talk about what it's like to have to, you know, because the history of passing in the African-American community, but what that looks like, what those stories do to generations. So I get so excited about it because there's so many things that we have that we want writers to be brave to step out of their genre. If you're used to writing poetry, listening to poetry, we're asking you to start thinking about creative nonfiction. Start thinking about playwriting. Start thinking about screenwriting. We're also trying to appeal to the younger audience who may not feel like they don't know which genre to build in, or an older audience who's always been taught only one, stick to one genre. We're saying get out of your own skin. Try something new. And this is the place to do it.
That's Carla Dupre. Executive Director of City Lit Project here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the 15th annual City Lit Festival happening this Saturday, April 14th at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center. You mentioned poetry. There seems to be an emphasis on poetry this year. Is that a different gateway for reading and writing audiences?
There is, but let me tell you this. Poetry, a lot of people read poetry, but a lot of people don't listen to it. And we think there's a different experience when you listen to poets. We're featuring Elizabeth Acevedo, who has a debut book out called Poet X, about a young teen coming into her own as a spoken word artist. And this young teen is living in it's kind of a strict Catholic home, but what it's like to find her own voice. We're featuring Furious Flower Poetry Center, who's the founder, Joanne Gabin, is from Baltimore. She's going to talk about starting the first academic center for African-American poetry. We're trying to introduce poets, because my experience with Furious Flower is that if you write poetry, you need to know about this center. They do fabulous conferences, fabulous workshops, fabulous tributes to our best-known legendary poets. They've done Toni Morrison. They've done Lucille Clifton, Maya Angelou. We're trying to get the literary audience connected in a very different way. And we're trying to grow their experience. And to me, writing's about opening up yourself to different kind of experiences. Writing is about empathy. We're trying to get people to understand that there's a big world out there. We are here. This particular region is filled with different cultures, and there's nothing like seeing themselves reflected on the page. And we're also trying to tell the arts community that the literary artists are here. We hear a lot about the fine arts, you know, performing arts and visual arts, but literary artists are here in this region, and we're strong.
Are there any highlights you haven't already shared with us? You're so excited about this.
I am excited about
festival.
It. Well, one thing I have to say, this festival is in its 15th year, and our founder, Greg Wilhelm, is about to leave this area to take on a position as director of the creative writing department at George Mason University.
I did not know that.
Yes. So this is
a farewell.
Kind of like a farewell to him, because we know he's always like one step away from us. But this is a way to say that, look, this is what you did. You know, bringing this festival, this kind of organization is very unique. There aren't a lot of places like City Lit. And for 15 years, we put a lot of people on this stage, a lot of platforms for writers, spoken word artists, emerging artists, putting them on the stage with, you know, seasoned artists. That's kind of like paying homage to him too, saying, look what you've done. You've created this great thing.
So there's a 15-year legacy, but what would you hope a first-time visitor comes away with after visiting the City Lit Festival?
Well, I'll tell you what, I just spoke to someone who just moved into the area, and she said she's moved from Philadelphia. She's trying to find a literary arts community. And what I said to her was, there's no way you're going to walk away from this festival thinking you're alone. There's no way. There are too many people, too many resources. We have 40 exhibitors in our literary marketplace. These are people who publish. These are people who have magazines. These are people who are interested, invested in the literary arts community. There is no way anyone will walk away from this festival thinking they're alone. Our editors, they make sure they're not told to reach back and talk to some of the people that whose manuscripts they critique. But they do, because they realize that writing can be a lonely experience. But in Baltimore, in this region, no way. No way, we got you. And we want to tell writers too, we want to tell funders that look at us, we're here, take care of us, take care of these individual literary artists, take care of people like City Lit. You know, recognize that we have an impact, a huge impact.
I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carla Dupre is executive director of City Lit Project. The 15th annual City Lit Festival runs from 9:30 to 5:30 this Saturday, April 14th, at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center at 11 West Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. After the break, we'll talk with the festival's keynote speaker, Philip Gorevich. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The 15th annual City Lit Festival is happening on Saturday. That's our topic today. We heard about some of the festival highlights from City Lit Project Executive Director Carla Dupre. One of those highlights is keynote speaker Philip Gurevich, who joins us today by phone. Gurevich has been a staff writer at The New Yorker for more than 20 years and served as editor of the Paris Review for 5 years. He's the author of The Ballad of Abu Ghraib, Standard Operating Procedure, and also of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and a place on the Guardian newspaper's list of the 100 greatest nonfiction books of the last 2,500 years. Gurevich is completing another book called You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. Welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you.
Philip Gurevich, your book, We Wish to Inform You, was a gripping account of the horrors of the Rwandan state-sponsored genocide in which 800,000 Tutsis were massacred in a matter of months. You wrote that 20 years ago. How do you think the experience of reporting so in-depth on that event has shaped you as a writer?
It's always difficult to say because it's hard to know how things would have gone if I hadn't done something. And so, in some ways, of course, it's just a very deep part of me over time. I suppose that at some level, writing about the Rwandan genocide and the world's response and the immediate aftermath and the dilemma of how, in the aftermath of such intensive and intimate communal killing and violence, people are supposed to reconstitute a society. I certainly think of it as a kind of deep political education. Oddly, at the time, I would have said, well, I went there with a fairly pessimistic view of history, which is not to say that everything's terrible, but that I don't think that things necessarily improve much. Came away with that confirmed. But 20 years later, although things are still very fragile and troubled there, I have a somewhat more of a sense that things can change.
Well, let me pick up on that because, of course, your next book, this coming book, is also about Rwanda, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. Tell us what it's about.
Really, it's returning to Rwanda over the last decade now. So from about the time of the 15th anniversary of the genocide till now, where we're on the, right now, Rwanda is in the course of this week commemorating the 24th anniversary of the genocide of 1994. And I was really looking at how is it that, I mean, right at the time that I first went there, which was a year afterwards, you really had a very strong sense from almost everybody that nobody could tell you how can this be put back together. In Eastern Europe, after the fall of communism, they used to have an expression, I think mostly from Poland, but everybody was using it, which was, we all know it's easy to make fish soup out of an aquarium, but nobody really knows how to make an aquarium out of fish soup. And it's a pretty good graphic image for just, you know, when things are so wrecked, how do you reconstitute a viable society from it? And it really was dumbfounding, because at that point, close to a million people had been killed. Out of a population of about 7.5 to 8 million, at least half the population of those who were remained were displaced, either internally or as refugees outside the country. A million people who had been refugees before the war were streaming back into a country that they barely knew, and that had been destroyed. The infrastructure was destroyed. And so there was also this feeling, this can't go away quickly. However, wrong, all the ideas and identity politics that might have led to this level of violence, and however transparently exposable they are as errors, blood makes them true. This level of fear and violence and the impulse to revenge is going to make this go on for a long time to come. And there were years of violence that followed, though it was a diminishing level of violence, especially inside Rwanda. Some of it continued quite terribly in Congo for a long time, and to this day. But in Rwanda, there was a stability under essentially an authoritarian, at first mostly military, but now a sort of established authoritarian state, and a process of, again, top-down forced coexistence that has become with time, and certainly to a degree, quite real. And one always has to wonder, how solid is it? How fragile is it? There's in some way no way to know until a lot of time goes by. But the longer that time goes by, I can say that nobody would have bet 25 years ago or 24 years ago that it would have come this far in the form that it has. And so that is remarkable. And it's demanded a great deal of the actual people who are living there in terms of restraint, in terms of overcoming extremely bitter feelings, in terms of accepting what seems like a very unacceptable set of arrangements as the least bad alternative and the only one that can be made better. And to some extent, thinking that maybe there's some hope that a future generation won't carry this as poisonously.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast speaking with Philip Gurevich, longtime New Yorker staff writer and author. He'll be the keynote speaker at the City Lit Festival on Saturday. We're talking about his book project in the works, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. That title implies a burden on both sides. Do you have a sense of it falling more heavily on the victims or the former killers?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. When I first heard that phrase, it was a long time ago. It was 20-some years ago. It's an expression in Kinyarwanda, the language of Rwanda. When I first heard it, I thought it was very dark, very sinister, or cynical. You hide that you hate me and I hide that I know. That it was a kind of a gallows humor at best when people would say it, you know, like, ain't that the way it is? And then I started to think about it more recently when I was going back in the recent years, and I thought, it's actually a description of civil order. What's the alternative? The alternative is that you don't hide it. And we know where that leads. So you can't ask everybody to get rid of, I mean, hate's a strong word, but any, you know, adversarial feelings and hostilities and resentment and fears and all of that. But you can ask them not to manifest them. And with time, you can hope that by doing so, you create an order that's its own reward, and that organizes people well. I mean, it's not that different from what the British might have called the gentlemanly code. And so it does lay a burden on everybody. And as somebody said to me at one point when I was asking them, you know, do you know this expression, Rwanda? And they're like, well, yes, everybody knows that expression. And he said, but of course what it means is nothing's hidden. Because if we both know what's being hidden, it's not exactly a secret. So what they mean by hiding is really not manifesting violent antagonisms, feelings of vengeance, feelings that divide people in a way that makes society non-functional.
Were you able to locate and interview people you had talked to for the first book?
Yeah, some of them, certainly not all of them, but many of them. And in fact, a good deal of my time from the very beginning, I was always interested in going back to one particular village where there was a killer and a set of the survivors of the families that he and his crew had attacked, whom I had met in 1996 the first time. And I'd always wondered how the whole thing had played out in the long aftermath. And over the last decade, I've gone back there repeatedly to that one very small community and followed both him and some of these survivors for what ended up being for the rest of their lives as they had their went through the various stages of dealing with the fact that they had to live around each other. But so, yes, many people were findable, though that first book was reported before really the internet had reached Rwanda and, or was much functional here even.
In We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, you reveal details of a genocide that much of the world ignored while it was happening. What are you hoping to accomplish in writing this next book?
Well, I think that the first book, in a sense, is more obvious as to why it might interest us, that we know that we might be interested in learning about something immense that took place in our own lifetime. But in fact, I think that in terms of the real complexity and immensity of the story comes out much more in the aftermath. In some odd way, I sometimes say the genocide was the easy part. And by that, I don't mean for people to live through. I mean to get one mind around. You know, it's consuming violence. You'll never fully get it, but you understand that once it was underway, it followed a kind of pattern. But what's being demanded of people when they're being asked to reconcile or forgive or just accept and coexist with others who have offended to that degree? And you ask yourself really fundamental questions, like, shouldn't some things be unforgivable? And isn't anger both a burden and a virtue? And, you know, is memory always, as we often say, oh, we must always remember everything, never forget, and remember as a kind of cure, because the things that get forgotten are silenced, and what's silenced will come back to bite us in one way or another. There's a lot of truth to that. That's why we all are aware of it. But also, memory can be a terrible burden and a kind of heavy weight. And, you know, in the 90s, when the genocide happened, there was a widespread view, I think, in the world, at least amongst Westerners in the United States or in Europe looking at Rwanda, that, well, you know, we're lucky, we've sorted out how things should be run in a society. They should adapt and be more like us. We've got everything sorted out about these kinds of conflicts or so. And we forget that in Europe it happened 45 years ago. Now we're at a time in American history where the Civil War seems more pressingly, urgently hot than it has since 150 years ago, maybe, in terms of our public debates and the unresolved issues that trailed behind it. You know, things that you think are settled aren't. And so I think that these immense questions of how does one put a society together, how does one make an aquarium out of fish soup, I'm not going to be able to answer those fully, but I can certainly explore them in a case where a lot of people are really grappling with that at the deepest possible level. And I think that that is what I hope to describe.
Lots to think about. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich, longtime staff writer at The New Yorker. We've been talking about his upcoming book, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know. At noon Saturday, Gurevich will keynote the 15th City Lit Book Festival at the University of Baltimore's William H. Thummel Business Center, 11 West Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening On the Record. Be back with us tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!